Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00027. Recorded on March 13, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Woefully mutated. Woefully mutated. Chapter 27.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I'm going to get right into the reading, right? I'm not going to play around. I'm not going to segue into it or anything. This one is called Woefully Mutated, right? And by this one, what I mean to refer to is the next edition of the found old fiction files, the introductory chapters to a story I was developing back in the year 2006 and going into 2007. We're going back quite a little while, 15 years or so. I don't know, is that the math? Yeah, that's about right. 14, 15 years, something in that idea. So this chapter is called Woefully Mutated. Woefully Mutated. And without any further ado, okay, let's go. A bare elm stood in the crisp early evening at the leaf-covered base of a hillside forest, and the low branch raked across the slats around a cracked window on the back side of a crooked wooden garage. From around front came the sound of crunching gravel stones. The crunching stopped, and a low creaking pined out, followed by a flat thud. The shack trembled slightly. A light flashed on and the window glowed. Inside, through a missing slat in a crooked louvered blind, a wiry little freak of a man appeared. He tore a red wool hat from his head, and the overhead light glazed on his bald crown. He stared down into an open cigarette box in his hand, mouthing a count slightly with his lips, subtly bouncing a graying soul patch on his chin. He closed the lid of the pack and jammed the box into a back pocket on his jeans. He started off across the floor, and as he stepped, beaten scraps of cracked linoleum crunched beneath his combat boots, and a dusted strand of brown cobweb fluttered from the ceiling above him. The place was a grungy studio dive sectioned out of the garage. It was askew with dirty laundry, fast food wrappings, beer cans, empty cigarette packs, grime, and dust. A dread smell of rancid rot pulsed sharply from a gray pool teeming with floating chunks in a stained ceramic sink to his right. Another rotten odor, this one a bit fruitier, like fermentation, came from the overflowing waste can in the corner to his left. From the floor beside a refrigerator crawled the blinding waft of ammonia from a neglected cat box. He paused at the center of the kitchen area and scratched at the black tuft of some odd half-mohawk strip on the backside of his head. He then grabbed at a frayed cuff of the stinky and tattered old denim he was wearing over a beaten gray sweater. The jacket smelled like a wet dog, and the sweater smelled like cigarette smoke. He shrugged and shimmied his way out of the denim and, turning back slightly, draped it lazily on the handlebar of a rusted bicycle propped up against the wall beside the trash can. He headed across the kitchen, grinding litter box stones into the floor as he made his way to the refrigerator. He pulled open the refrigerator door, and inside was an arrangement of science experiments gone woefully mutated. There was a browned salad, crinkled fruit, and a quart of milk that had coagulated into a funky green cheese. There was a sticky spill of orange splatter on one shelf and yellow trails on the wall leading to another. Three open foam containers of pizzeria tomato sauce were all breathing through a fuzzy mold. A 12-pack cardboard carrying case of canned beer stood proudly gleaming amongst it all. He took a can and turned, closing the door behind him. The refrigerator waddled. As he stepped away from the refrigerator, he blindly nudged the overloaded litter box with his ankle. A grainy lump of cat shit breached the plastic container wall and fell to the floor. He looked at the turd emptily and continued on, dragging his carcass in a mope out of the kitchen area and into the living room. The living room area was decorated in unmatched pieces of furniture, some secondhand and some transformed from a prior and unrelated purpose. One end table was a stack of milk crates, another was a cable spool, and the bookshelf was a cardboard box tipped on its side. There was guitar equipment with wires and pedals strewn all about. There were posters of musicians and marijuana leaves and skulls on the wall. There was a stack of yellowing newspapers in one corner and a pile of dirty clothes in another. There was a picture of a girl in a frame atop an empty beer keg, the louvered shades in the window, caked with a nicotine-tarnished dust, were drawn. He mindlessly stomped on an empty pizza box as he passed. A fuzzy black cat without a name peeked out from behind a milk crate in the corner, but uninterested, resumed its never-ending task of licking itself clean. The man threw his cigarette pack down on a table and dropped his ass in the middle cushion of a beaten tweed couch. He reached across a head-stained armrest and ignited a child's lighthouse lamp. In the warm light of the lamp, he appraised the panorama of the coffee table before him. He began to scavenge through the taco wrappers, used napkins, and empty beer cans in and around an open magazine, from which a lovely young lady shamelessly displayed her breast and genitalia to the spent overhead bulb on a ceiling above. He accidentally pushed a stuffed ashtray over the table's edge, dumping it on the area rug beside a cat-sized aluminum pie tray. The cat scattered. Reaching a hand to the floor between his seasoned boots, he blindly waved through the tiny gap between the couch and the rug in a continued search, traipsing his fingertips haphazardly through cobwebs, cat fuzz, ghost turds, and random bits of dried-up food scrap. He came up with a nickel and a bottle cap, and his bony, rutted face scrunched with dissatisfaction. With a labored grunt, he reluctantly hoisted himself from his seat and lunged over to the television. The screen was misty with dust and static cat fuzz. He poked his finger to a button at its base, manually powering it up. Turning back to the couch, he spotted the protruding edge of the remote control peering out from beneath the pizza box on the floor. Television came to life behind him, and the nameless cat popped out of hiding, leaping suddenly onto a dust-covered guitar amplifier across the room. It licked the inside of one front paw and wiped at its face, squinting tranquilly in concentration. The man sat his ass back into the couch and reached down for the remote. The handheld device was fully adorned with seasons of sticky fingerprints and various swipes of hand slime. A swatch of masking tape held the battery door in place just fine, but a crack running across the width of the numbered keypad rendered its usefulness questionable. He pointed it at the television and pressed the number 5. Nothing happened. He pressed again, and nothing happened again. He tried the numbers 1 and then 2, which resulted in nothing and nothing more. He condemned the remote in a frustrated whisper. "Freaking wicked piece of shit," he sneered, and tossed it aside without further regard. It sailed across the coffee table, striking a third-rate electric guitar that was covered with stickers and missing 2 strings. The cat scattered. The man twisted and laid himself back into the couch, facing toward the television. He took up the can of beer, swigged it, and rested the can upon his chest. A situation comedy, a rerun episode, had just started into a scene. The man belched the beer deeply, and then he squeaked out a shallow fart. He reached over to the pack of smokes on the table, unsheathed a cigarette, and snatched up a matchbook. He lit the cigarette with a match and waved the flame out. He flipped the spent matchstick to the coffee table and dragged the smoke heavily and deeply, exhaled a cloud, and kissed off a single smoke ring. He stared at the television and sunk into the fiction of the show, where a petite and bubbly wife was giving her large and dumpy husband a hard time about sitting on a couch watching television. He looked away from the TV and stared up at the ceiling, where a leggy spider scurried along, headed for the wall, out past the far end of the couch. The television suddenly fuzzed out with a bark and a hiss. The man groaned and angrily flipped an ash toward the screen. He reluctantly propped himself up and lurched forward into the very drifting ashes that he just set aflight. He reached the top of the television box with both hands and tinkered with the wire hanger and aluminum foil adornments that formed an antenna. When the signal was recovered, the sitcom resumed with a burst of laughter. He had missed a joke and resumed his seat on the couch, flipping an ash mindlessly at the coffee table as he fell back. He grabbed a beer can, took another swig, and turned his glass to the digital clock atop television. It glowed a dusty amber, 7:42 p.m. He slammed the remaining beer and tossed the emptied can aside haphazardly, belching again. A thick gust kicked up outside, maybe the first good thrust of winter for the year. A faint whistle sighed from a rotted window jamb. Outside, an elm loosed a flurry of dried brown leaves, and a naked twig from a barren branch tapped a skeleton gallop across a dirty glass pane. The shifting rafters creaked and pined. A low moan grew out from the eaves. A cool draft found its way into the room, bleeding in from the garage through a gap in the uncovered wall behind the refrigerator. Amidst the harrowing sounds of the winds and the trees, the cat pranced lightly into the middle of the room and sat, staring at the man who sat silently smoking a cigarette, staring into space. So there you go. Woefully mutated. Woefully mutated. Did you catch it? It was a reference to leftovers in a refrigerator that had spoiled and become some semblance of a scientific experiment or two. Yes, the food had woefully mutated. And when I think of that phrase, woefully mutated, first thing that comes into my mind is transhumanism, right? Transhumanism. You know what transhumanism is? A lot of you sci-fi people get it, right? It's a long-standing concept in the science fiction community, as in so many stories. And really, you know, it has a basis in our reality. The basis is the continuity of existence, right? The want to live forever, or at least longer, right? the idea of transhumanism is basically achieving longevity by the means, and it's probably not limited to these means, but just, you know, right off the top of my head, genetic modifications and even mechanical. It's like attaching yourself to a computer, right, to continue to exist. And it's this idea of transhumanism is a step in the quote-unquote evolutionary process, where we kind of just grow out of our own manner of being and start to take on a whole new humanity as a result of our technological prowess and expertise. You can see, really, we have a world where, wherever you are in the world, you got, politically speaking, and I'm not getting into politics here, I'm just saying, politically speaking, you got a political spectrum with a left and a right. And the left represent, well, the right represents that which is conservative, and then it has variations thereof. And on the left, with variations also, is the ideology of those who are regarded as quote-unquote progressive, right? And the driver of the progressiveness, it's the progress away from that which is traditional and into really the technological and scientific unknown. It's heavy thinking, and I don't know if a lot of your minds actually have grasped that fact, but that's how we're going, right? We're going away from mysticism and forward into technology. Technologicalism. Is that even a word? Hey, when I say it, it's a word, okay? Break out your dictionary and go between whatever, and just scratch in, Maverick 88 made this word, and it's legitimate. Right? It's always legitimate. So, a progressive ideology has got its pull, its ambition is the desire to live forever, or to seriously extend one's longevity. And that is the driving mechanism that rips progressive thought away from traditional, mythological, mystic types of thinking, like religion and things like that, right? It's the idea that we have that which we can perceive within a limited scope of time, you know, less than 100 years generally, you know, somewhere between 70 and 100 years, a normal span of life in the modern age. And without a base of faith that is spiritual and involves an afterlife, life is extinguished in its entirety at the point of what we know as death. Now, progressive thinking shuns and shuts out all of the mysticism and mythology in exchange for what the capacity and capability of humanity is technologically, scientifically, and using that, be it limited skill, to advance the longevity of our individual being. Because it's all we got. And that's our survival instinct minus faith, generating a technological answer to a natural problem. So the force behind such a thing, obviously, are people that don't have faith. People that don't have a spiritual life. People that don't have a sense of afterlife and an ongoing presence in eternity. That's the driving factor. And that's why people who are religious tend to be conservative. Not always, you know, not always. But they tend to be conservative in so many ways. And the people who are not religious, not always, but very frequently, by and large, tend to be progressive. Like I said, there's variations all the way through, right? So I talked around politics without getting into politics. Did I not? Did I not? And did I not? Okay? That was my commitment to you in these regards. What I'm trying to say is there are certain kind of people that really want for transhumanism to occur. And the driving force behind it is the instinct of survival. Like I said, it's a theme in so much of science fiction, right? Science fiction, obviously, it's science and it's fiction, but you know, it tends towards times that are future from us now, where the writers and creators of books and shows or whatever media, comic books, can build a world upon their imagination and fill it up with all kinds of gadgets and equipment, tools and toys of innovation. And I actually enjoy science fiction, even though I'm not a transhumanist type of person by any stretch of the imagination. I don't really see the point in it, but again, it's a matter of a person of faith versus a person of no faith, and our worldview as the result of it. But anyway, you know, back to the science fiction. I mean, recently, I have actually two very recent encounters with transhumanism in the science fiction that I've been taking in, right, as entertainment. And one of them is in the Star Trek Enterprise, right? That's from the early 2000s. Where they have four seasons. And they should have had a fifth, but they cut it when they cut it for whatever reason, and it's not my problem. But there was an episode or two. It was like a double episode, I think. A really big deal. And here's a situation. Like that Star Trek Enterprise, through its duration, had fairly routinely incorporated actors who portrayed roles on the Star Trek The Next Generation iteration of the Star Trek universe. And in this one particular case, you know, sometimes they would be like on screen actors just portraying different roles, you know. Kind of like guest appearance type of stuff. And in other instances, if you catch the credits rolling by, they're like directing certain episodes. That's really cool. That's like the people, there's a continuity to it all. There's a sense of family and connectedness to the development of all these Star Trek projects. And I think that's a cool thing. You know, I think it's a cool thing. And it's probably the reason why Star Trek Enterprise ended up coming off so fucking good. I mean, really, to me, it's top three of every different approach, different program that they have, whatever you want to call it, right? I like the new one that they have going on. That's the other prequel to the original series, right? Yes. They completed their first season and it's out there waiting for a second. And I don't even remember what the hell it's called. It is very good. It's the captain before Captain Kirk. It's got Spock in it. It's really, really, really fucking good. I like the original series also. And I like this Star Trek Enterprise. The Next Generation is worth watching, right? Star Trek The Next Generation is worth watching. It's not bad. But I like this better. I like this better. But anyway, all that to say that the actor who played Data, right? Data, the Pinocchio character in Star Trek The Next Generation, and one of the actual top science fiction characters ever fucking written into a script, ever, right? I talk about how Spock is like greatest fiction character, science fiction character ever made, but Data is like right up there with them, right? And it's very interesting because, and I may have said this before, and I don't mean to get into it, but I just can't help it. I'm right there at the moment. You know, Spock was the Vulcan, he was the alien, and he was doing everything he could to deny the humanity within him, right? He was a half-bastard. He was half-human, half-alien, but he was raised on Vulcan as a Vulcan, and he was always fighting against his own humanity and always making fun of human beings and the ways of human beings. And then when they come out with Star Trek The Next Generation, right, that was the following TV series, albeit a very long gap in between, right? They ran a couple of movies through the 80s, and then eventually they came up with the ambitious goal, trying to continue Star Trek. And it worked. They did a very good job of it. They come up with new characters, and when you're coming up with a new main cast, you know, who are officers on a starship called Enterprise, there's going to be comparisons, right? And Data obviously appears to be like the replacement for Spock. And that is a fucking tall order, right? But opposite of Spock, he was, like I use the word Pinocchio character, right? He was an android who was programmed to develop his humanity. So as Spock was trying to diminish and squash his humanity, Data was trying to become a human, though he was not human at all, right? He was an android. So it was a very interesting twist. I mean, how do you make your Spock character not be Spock? You just have him go in the opposite direction, right? Which, you know, well, whatever. I don't want to add any more to it, but it was fantastic. Anyway, all right, Data, right? Data, the actor who played Data is named Brent Spiner. He's a Texan. He's from Houston. I looked it up. I just happened to stumble on it. And he played Data in Star Trek Enterprise at one part, but he played another character also. And the character he played was this guy called Dr. Eric Soong, S-O-O-N-G. And why do I bring him up? Well, because Dr. Soong's specialty was basically transhumanism, right? He was doing all kinds of genetic modifications, and he had like basically reared a family of transhuman beings, and it was outlawed, and he was outlawed, and it was all this crazy shit, and he had planted them somewhere, basically, for when the proper time came to spring them to life. You know, it was a multi-episode story, really, really done well. I'm telling you, man, Star Trek Enterprise was a good, good show. Especially, it got better as it went, you know. When you get into the third season, they changed the way they did things. Every episode up to that point was kind of standalone, kind of slowly developing a continuity in terms of like character interaction and everything like that. When they get into the third season, like the whole season became a story. Really, the whole rest of it became this story. They were on a mission, and every story led to the next. You had to watch one to the next to get what the hell was going on, right? And, it was just done very well. Very imaginative, very real. Stories never jump in the shark. Fucking good. Just really, you got, if you ain't seen it, go see it. All right. So on the topic of transhumanism, you know, and science fiction. Before we get to science fiction, we're gonna pull from science fiction, okay? Because back in the '90s, right? Back in the '90s, I did a lot of weightlifting. Me and a couple of my friends, you know, and we'd get all amped up on caffeine, and we'd buy supplements and shit. And we were all scrawny, we were trying to get big and muscle bound. And it was around the time when White Zombie came out with Astro Creep 2000, right? And I had that on CD, and the song played. The main, like their single played on the radio like every fucking hour, right? Yeah, it was called More Human Than Human, right? And we used it in weightlifting, and the way I thought of it, like, A, it was like my song. That song came on, and all of a sudden, all right, that was it. And there was something about, like, I was not trying to be transhuman. I was trying to fulfill my humanity. And a little bit different in that regard. But that song would get me up and going. And we'd be like in the basement lifting weights. We'd play it like five times over. Ba-boom, boom. Ba-boom, boom. Ba-boom, boom. Rob Zombie's style was very unique and very cool. Very cool. You know, it's like that dark new metal with a kind of rap sort of melody to it. But real heavy bass and thudding drums and a little slow, that it left a lot of room for stuff in between the beats of the rhythm, and fucking, it was really, really good, innovative music, and I'm not really here to do a whole rundown on Rob Zombie and all his creativity. Very popular, very well known in culture. Oh, he did that freaky carnival clown movie, I can't remember the name of it, but it was freaky. He did actually did the section of illustration of animation in Beavis and Butthead Does America when they got into a peyote trip in the desert. So he did the music behind it. He did the animation in the front of it. And he's just done a bunch of stuff, you know. He's a horror slash sci-fi kind of guy. In fact, it is what I'm getting to. You know, More Human Than Human is a transhumanist song. And the inspiration comes from a sci-fi movie called Blade Runner, right? Blade Runner, 1982. You've heard it. You've seen it. And I went and saw it again fairly a couple, 3 weeks ago, something like that. And it was never really my favorite, right? Like, I got to tell you, I'm not a huge sci-fi guy. I like certain sci-fi that's very, just done very well. Very well, very thoughtfully, and I don't know, it's to my taste, so I don't really know how to describe it beyond that. And not everything is to my taste. Blade Runner was, there's a story there. The cinematography, it was really peculiar, especially for that time. It was definitely way ahead of its time. There was a great darkness to it, if you like darkness, which I do, but I don't know. It just wasn't capturing me. I think the story was getting lost in the audio, right? The story being told was being lost in the density of the dark ambiance. It's hard to describe. It's just something like that. The visual was just greater than the audio in it, and it's just hard to stay focused, you know, and really catch everything that was going on. But there were just so many great lines, you know, in it. But I bring it up because, all right, the White Zombie song More Human Than Human was inspired by the movie Blade Runner. The movie Blade Runner was all about these synthetic humans. They were called Nexus, right? There was different, like, generations of these transhumanist synthetic human entities. And they were up to like Nexus 6 was really badass, but the problem with them is they had a very short shelf life, right? They weren't long for the world, but as long as they were there, they were very powerful, very threatening, and the Blade Runner guy, was played by Harrison Ford, was basically some iteration of a cop whose job it was to go hunt these guys, these synthetic beings, down before they can do harm, right? That was the basic gist of the whole thing. These guys were the Nexus 6, badass, right? The line from More Human Than Human, right? The White Zombie song at the end of it. I want more life, fucker, I ain't done. That comes from the movie, right? There's a part where the Nexus 6 character, I want more life. You know, he's begging to try to find a way to stay alive longer. It's a little ironic. Like, I start out saying the idea of transhumanism is that we would live longer. But now here you've got a transhuman being that actually lives shorter. Right? Because it's still prototype type stuff. They're figuring it out as they go. this is not to be an entire breakdown of that movie, but there's just a whole connection, transhumanism, all the way through any kind of science fiction, into Rob Zombie, which gets into our pop culture, musically speaking, and carries on as far as that's going to ride out into the future. Who can say? Who can say? Now, you know, speaking of Blade Runner, right? Well, you know, there's another quote. There's another quote. Hang on. Well, let me say this. I bring up Blade Runner, but I can't help but not mention that I came into, right, a new blade, a new knife this weekend. Fell into my lap. $0. Zero cost to me. Given by my in-laws, right? They were going through stuff that was being stored in a tool shed in the backyard, my backyard. And as they were going through the stuff, they happened on this old knife. It's old, but brand new. It was in storage, not used. And I laid eyes on it. I was like, whoa, you know, what are you all going to do with this? And the guy handed it to me. Right? All right. And I did research on it. You know, I found out what it was. It's I'm familiar. When I looked at it, like, I had a basic familiarity with what I was dealing with. I knew it was the real deal knife. And the company, you know, inscribed on the knife was called Bear MGC. But I knew immediately that that was Bear and Son, right? Bear and Son is a very well-known American cutlery company. And so this is something from their line. And their line of stuff, you know, like when you're talking about like fixed blade knives, generally very expensive. I don't mean like $1,000 expensive, but $150, $250, $350. I don't have a Bear and Son because they cost a little bit more than all the other stuff I seem to buy, right? But I like the idea. I like them because they are all American. They always have been. And to this day, you know, even the companies that still make stuff over here, they have like certain little divisions that they do manufacturing overseas, you know, usually in China and Taiwan. These guys know. They just will not do that. They will not do that. They'll make cheap stuff, you know, almost garbage knives, but they'll make it here. You know, if you want to get on board and have something with their name on it, you can get something for $30. You know, you ain't getting much, but you're getting something. But anyway, beside all that, I knew basically what I was looking at. And this thing, all right, it's a Bowie knife. It's a Bowie knife. It's 7-inch blade, 7.5-inch blade, actually. So it's not small. It's not huge. Yeah, it had bone handles, right? Bone handles. And brass fittings and guards. And it was Damascus steel. All this shit that adds up to ching ching, more money, more money, more money. Now, I'm not thinking of it in terms of, hey, somebody gave me this knife, I can turn around and sell it for $200 or whatever, you know, whatever it's worth. No, I like knives. I'm keeping this fucking thing. I'm going to give this down to my wife's boys, or soldiers in the army, right? You know, when my time is done, they're getting it. It's coming from their family anyway, this particular knife, and it's going to stay there, right? I have no need to sell this. You know, if I sold it, I would take the money and do what? Buy a knife. That's what I do. But, yeah, I got this blade, right? Speaking of Blade Runner, and it's a Bear MGC WSB-01D. That is white, soft, bone, 01 Damascus. A Bowie knife. You know, 7.5-inch blade, like I said. And, you know, it's really cool. I went on the internet to find out what I could find out about this, and I couldn't find out much at all. I found out that there's a number two version of it that's out there that you could still buy. But it's a 9-inch blade and a little bit taller. This is like one and almost 1.5 inches tall. Actually, more like 1 3/8, I think I measured it at. And then the number two model is like 1 3/4 inches, right? So it's a little bit taller, actually, it might be 1.625. I forget what I read now. But it's taller and longer, right? It's a 9-inch blade that's comparable to the K-Bar Big Brother that I have. I keep out of my workshop, right? It's a big chunk of a Bowie type of knife. And that thing is selling from $300 to $400, right? Brand new as it is now. Now, it's a little bigger, so you got to... If they still made this 7.5-inch blade today, it would be a little bit cheaper than the $300 to $400 that it's running for now. It would be going probably for like $260, $270. And I'm trying to find out stuff about it. All I could find out is what's replaced it. I went on the manufacturer's website. I was just like, I'll see if I can contact anybody over there. And I'm thinking, they probably got like a secretary or somebody like that who gets all these generic contact form emails. I send that out. 15 minutes later, I get a fucking response from the president, the founder of this company, right? He's going to look into it himself for me. He asked if I would send him some pictures and just tell him whatever I could, I had this back and forth with this guy all afternoon on Saturday while he's helping me, And he comes, he says he could tell me for a fact that the knife is pre-2004, but he can't tell me exactly which year it was produced. He said there was a lot of them produced at the time, so as far as it being a collector, maybe not. Its original MSRP was $225 all the way back then, so we're talking like 9/11 era, right? Somewhere around then, probably. It could be even a little older than that. It could go back into the 90s some. But, the dollar then versus now, it was $225 back then. And there wasn't a whole lot much more to say about it. I got the impression through email text that he didn't really regard it as any kind of a collector thing. But I did find a few of them online, going up for auction. There's like 3 or 4 different ones of them. But I couldn't get the details that they had. You had to like sign up for an account and all this shit. And it was like, But anyway, how cool is that though? You got a national company that is well known to anybody who collects knives. And you've got the founder and president of the company sitting there on Saturday afternoon at his desk responding to your communications. So, of course, I'm compelled to go buy an actual Bear & Son knife, and I'm shopping through them. I think I found one that I like that'll actually be something I could use for work, And I just got to go hunt one down and pick it up. I just bought a knife. I just bought that knife, the Cold Steel, so I'm going to kind of wait a month, come around and get the next one. But yeah, really cool. Blade Runner becomes Blade. But going back to Blade Runner, I don't want to just walk away with it, because like I said, with Blade Runner, that was one of those kind of movies that lay out just a whole lot of quotes, like a whole lot of memorable quotes. And anybody who watches it picks up on something in particular. It's like the Godfather is one of those. If you're from New Jersey, right? If you're from New Jersey, you watch a Godfather or you watch like Sopranos, people around there communicate with each other, making the pop culture references to those particular shows. It's just something everybody watches up there more times than once, right? And even when you watch the Sopranos are always referencing the Godfather. That it was true to life, It was art copying life. It's the way it is up there when you're a Jersey person. You make all these references to mob stuff, mob shows, because that is the shared culture of North Jersey, right? So anyway, in Blade Runner, like I said, there was a lot of different quotes, but the one that really stuck out at me was right towards the end, before the main synthetic human, the Nexus 6 dude, was fixing to be terminated. He said, "Quite an experience living in fear. That's what it means to be a slave." Right? It's like, you know what? That is a fucking excellent quote. And I, for all you all out there who've seen that movie and have your own favorite quote from it, that's probably not it, you know. But to me it is. To me it is, because it triggers a couple of things in my psyche, right? The idea of fear, the idea of slavery, the relation between the two. If you know New Testament scripture, you know there's a relation between fear and slavery. Now, you know, I think in those terms, you know, I think of fear and faith as opposites, right? The opposite of fear is faith. If you're a fearful person, you are lacking in faith. If you're a faithful person, you are lacking in fear. And it's, again, it's a degree of magnitudes are involved with it. It always is. But basically, the more oriented towards faith you are, the more full of faith you are, the less full of fear you are, and vice versa. And you know, your faith will trump your fear, which goes back to the whole transhuman thing. Yeah? Transhumanism as a pursuit is a fear-based pursuit. You're afraid that you're not going to see everything that you could possibly see in this lifetime. You're afraid you're going to die before your time is due. You're afraid you're going to be there having your last gasp of air and be completely unfulfilled. You have not served any purpose. You may probably have never found any fucking purpose, right? There's all kinds of fear that comes along with dying. And it's exacerbated by the fact that you have no sense of an eternity in the afterlife. See what I'm saying? So it's a fear-based approach to life. And the worldview that is created is a fear-based worldview. You are if you are this kind of person, you are looking through you're looking at the world through lenses of fear. Project the potential impact of that perspective onto all things. See, to me, to my way of thinking, whenever I'm fearful, anxious, I'm like a powder keg. It's all knee-jerk reactions. It's all for the moment. It's all just to hang on and survive till the next thing. And I'm always scratching and looking for peace somewhere in it. It's desperation. When you live desperately, you're not living by any kind of formulated plan. And I think this whole idea of like science and technology is a cloak that gets thrown over top of that fear-based worldview, right? But I say, and I've long said, faith is greater than fear. And I'll steer your mind back to how I spent 2020, that fucked up year, right? Where everybody was getting locked down and there was that low grade of panic over it, and everybody's wearing the masks on their face. Y'all out in the future, I'm sure your history books in school are talking to those times, right? We are the people that lived in those times. We are in the post-COVID era now, but in 2020, we were in it, in the thick of it. There was all kinds of fucked up shit going on. I talk about lockdowns, right? The only people who could like get in their trucks and go off to work were quote unquote essential employees. You had to have something to do with the medical field or transportation, you know, some shit like that. You had to work for your counties, your cities, your states, the federal government. But it was really limited. All kinds of businesses were shut down. Bars, restaurants, you know, people who were running those kind of places went broke. You know, you ran a barber shop, you went broke. Beauty parlor, you went broke. Tattoo shop, you went broke. You got shut the fuck down. You know, you got shut down and shut out. And it was a really rough time, right? And people, you know, and it was the result of a pandemic. So you had, yeah, there was in the millions, I don't know what the number is, of people who died as, you know, who quote unquote died as a result of COVID-19. And while it was not the huge number that they were projecting, it was a large enough number that it touched just about everybody. You know, you knew somebody who died. I know two people who died. In fact, that person's going to come up a little bit. I'm not going to speak to him, but something else had happened in our friendship as we move along through this monologue here. But anyway, yeah, I mean, but I was spending my time going online every Saturday morning and putting together like an hour to an hour and a half worth of messaging, right? Messaging, scripturally based messaging that attacked the idea of the fears that people were having in the situation and preaching faith. This is to my family and to my friends, you know. It was a Facebook Live thing. So people who knew me that I knew were getting this message from me. And I did that without fail every fucking Saturday for a little bit more than a year, right? And I believe that's what I was preaching, and that's what I believe. It was always something about fear and faith. Sometimes it was specifically to that, but that was the whole purpose. The whole purpose was to go up there and draw people to their faith, leave their fear behind, right? Like I say, you got a fear-based worldview, you're going to have fear-based behaviors impacting the world. On the vice versa, if you have a faith-based worldview, you're going to have faithful behaviors impacting the world. That's what it really boils down to. I know a lot of people out there will be saying, you know, more people have died in the name of religion, la da 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 da. Hey, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater there. Right? Do not mistake Jesus Christ for the idiots that claim to believe in him and follow him. If there's murdering going out there in the name of any religious entity, the people who are doing the murdering are doing it on a basis of fear. A Christian, a quote-unquote, with a capital C, Christian, will thrive. And I mean that in a emotional response, right? That person will suddenly be fulfilled when they are facing the sword, when they are facing the firing squad, the guillotine, whatever. Anybody who's about to be killed on account of their faith, there's not the need to come to arms. The need is to subject yourself to the murder that's about to take place, and then you are martyred, and your place in eternity is fixed. And to be Christian is to believe that. Martyrdom is sacred, you know. It's a completely different way of thinking. It's like, oh, you don't like me because I'm Christian, and you want to kill me because I'm Christian? Go right the fuck ahead and do it. Or on the other hand, fearfully based people are thinking about transhuman approaches to extending this life here, right? So you got that polarity again. At that polarity, these are the linchpins of the polarity. What you believe in terms of the hereafter really sets the course for all the divisiveness. Does it not? Okay, moving on. Sort of, kind of. You know, we have not really moving on, because there's something I want to do. I want to read something. I want to read something from the Bible while we're at this juncture here, because it's going to come to mind, right? John chapter 8, verses 31 through 36. And it's the idea of being free in Jesus, you are free indeed. Okay. Oh, I know. They're whining. Here he goes with the Bible again. Listen to this. Just fucking listen to this, all right? Now, I have to dig it up for you. John 8:31. I'll do this quick. try to do it quick. John 8:31. Okay. The truth shall make you free. That's kind of like a section header in this version. I'm reading from the New King James Version, right? The truth shall make you free. John 8, verse 31 through 36. Then Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits a sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." Okay. I'm not going to say nothing about that. I'm just saying, I'm reading it to you. So your ears hear. Free indeed. Free indeed. Sin is the entrapment of slavery. It is your connection to slavery. And it's completely related to fear. Completely related to fear. Sin, I don't want to get into it. I don't want to get into it all. But, there's a relationship between sin and fear. The more faithful we are, the less we sin as a verb. But then sin as a noun is a prevailing way. It's like a fucking disease upon all of us that we're trapped with and that runs us. And it messes with our basic instincts, right? I've brought that up before. Instincts gone awry. That's a phrase from Alcoholics Anonymous, actually, in their literature, right? A-W-R-Y. Instincts gone awry. Talks to the idea of having a reason to behave a certain way, right? Or having instincts for a certain reason. Our craving to eat is part of our survival instinct, right? Our lust for each other is part of our procreation instinct. And when we start misapplying the behaviors related to the instincts, we have the indication that our instincts have gone awry, right? And when we get fearful, we start doing shit that exceeds their intended purpose. You know, a fearful person will do what? They'll kill people out of fear that they may be killed or that they may be kidnapped or enslaved, you know? If you're afraid of this shit happening, your response to it is going to be some form of wicked. I read that to you. And, you know, There's a point to it all. You know, the idea of faith, because some people, you say, well, look, okay, I could be a slave to sin. I could be a slave to another person. But isn't it slavery, on the other hand, if I submit myself to Jesus Christ or any other religious entity? Don't I then become their slave? It's like no matter what I do, I have to submit to somebody or something, and I am thereby enslaved, right? Well, the thing about the submission is you could be forced into it or you could volunteer yourself into it. Makes sense? And that's really the dividing line between the two. You know, nobody's forcing like Jesus Christ on my life, on my beliefs, on my soul. It's not being forced. It's been presented to me through my life. And I take it as an affront when I don't want it. I take it as an imposition when I don't want it. It feels like an attack on me when I don't want it. But the truth is, all it is an offer, an exposure, an invitation. It's just information. I yet have the choice on whether to submit myself to that or any other base of faith or not. actual imposition is if you're kidnapped and thrown into slavery, like what has happened so many times in our existence, right? People with the gun to their head are told, work. Of course, my family went through that shit in Germany, right? It happened, and it happens still, and it'll probably happen for a while more. In every household, there's some sort of forced submission. And one of the chapters of my story talked to that sort of thing. I was starting to talk to that sort of thing. Anyway, but yeah, the idea that faith is a voluntary thing, therefore it's not actually slavery, right? It's different. But which also, you know, my time as a Protestant involved, what they call quote-unquote worship services that were really centered around a pastor doing a quote-unquote sermon for like an hour to 2 hours, right? That is way different than a liturgy, like what I'm involved with now as an Orthodox person, what I was involved with in my youth as a Catholic, a Roman Catholic person. And but we get these preachers that do these certain type of sermons with a particular approach to them, right? It's the old, and you've heard this before, hellfire and brimstone, right? He's up there preaching the hellfire and brimstone. If you sin, you will go to hell, right? That kind of stuff. And it's a scare tactic. It really is. That is an imposition. You're not attracting people to the faith. You are scaring them from consequences. I look at it as a scare tactic. You are actually working on the fears of people that they will go to hell or whatever other punishment comes with condemnation from your deity of choice, you know. The outcome ends up being this fear-based scare tactic. And it is some semblance of a fear-based religion, which again, even if you're religious, if you have the basis of fear at the foundation of your worldview, you are going to believe fucked up things and behave in a fucked up manner. So you've got some Christianity and some Islam and some of everything, really, that has this fear-based belief that even though they are religious people, their worldview is fucked up and dangerous. And in that, you have the perpetuation of killing in the name of quote-unquote God, capital G or lowercase g, whatever g, right? That's how it happens. It starts from the root of your faith. Are you afraid or are you faithful? It's big stuff. Faith is voluntary. Hellfire and brimstone. Fear-based religion. Fear. Fear the punk rock band. Fear the record, right? They made a couple of records, but I had, when I was a kid, Fear the Record. It came out while I was in high school, right? And I had punk rock friends, and I have friends who weren't punk rockers that listened to it. You know, me and a couple dudes in particular, both of them have passed at young ages, you know. They both gone, but we listened to it, you know. We had a cassette, as it was back then. It's like you couldn't have your own shit. You had to borrow your friends, you know. Between the three of us, we had a cassette, and one other person recorded it. The quality was very low. But we'd get together, we'd cruise around, and we'd crank out Fear the Record, Fear the punk rock band. I brought them up somewhere along the way before. Lee Vang, the singer. Love that stuff. I still love that stuff. I don't listen to it all the time because it gets me amped up, and then you don't want me amped up all the time. You know, there's moments when it's good. But I love it. I think it's to my taste, it's the best punk rock there ever was. You know, that album in particular. Just done so well. I think it was like on time in my life. You know, I was literally in high school. They say it was the music of my time. And I didn't like any of the music of my time. Not much of it anyway. Hardly any at all. But I like this. I like this. I couldn't listen to it all the time. And I was better served to be drunk and coked up when I did listen to it. You know, that's part of it also, you know. But it's a lot more thoughtful. And the musicians in the band were actually musicians. They weren't just like kids with shitty guitar equipment thrown at them. And it wasn't about like dressing a certain way and using certain lingo and, you know, making a bunch of fucking noise just to be an irritant, you know. It was actual music. These were musicians, and it proved out over the years. In fact, if I recall, like, there was a time when Flea, right? Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. He got famous with the Red Hot Chili Peppers as their bass player. But prior to that, somewhere along the way, for some stretch, he was the bass player for Fear, right? I believe that to be true. Check it out. See for yourself. But Fear the Record, 1982. Every song was great. The only one that I really didn't care for was the one cover that they did on it. They did an old Animals song. Which one? What the hell was it? It's not coming to my mind right now. We gotta get out of this place. I mean, I didn't mind when I was really young. I didn't mind the original version of that song. But Fear's cover of it, it wasn't theirs. It just wasn't theirs, and it didn't really have a feel to it, and it didn't make a good punk rock song. But man, the rest of it, the things that they wrote, the way they wrote it, the way they performed, Lee Vang's voice, unbelievable. What a great voice. You know, and he went on to become like a country artist and an actor. He liked country music. You can't get your hands on his stuff, but you can find it on YouTube. Just do a search for Lee Vang country music. I forget what it was. I should have looked it up. But man, it was very good. Very good. I mean, I listen to country music. I would listen to that. I would buy it if I could find it to purchase, and I would listen to it. I would download it to my phone. I'd buy a CD, whatever. I can't seem to locate it anywhere, but let's start a war. We could start it in New Jersey. I always love that song, Living in New Jersey. Let's start a war right the fuck here. Blame it on the middle class, which I've got problems with lately, living in suburbia. I mentioned, you know, when I did mention about Fear and Lee Vang, I mentioned the song Beef Bologna, which is that great song. It was about a girl who I think is vegan or vegetarian, but in spite of it, still likes the beef bologna, and leave it at that. Song, another one, I Don't Care About You. It's choruses. I don't care about you. Fuck you. I don't care about you. A line at the end of it, like the last verse. I seen an old man have a heart attack in Manhattan. Well, he died while we just stood there looking at him. Ain't he cute? I don't care about you. Fuck you. Right? There's so many, you know, and the song that closed out the album, you know, they added a little Fuck Christmas song to the CD later on, which is kind of funny, but the original rendition ended with a song called No More Nothing, a little short song. No More Nothing. And it talked about all this stuff. It mentioned this one thing at one point. It said, no more EST. And I don't think any of us knew what the fuck EST meant in 1982, 83, 84. As kids, right? We didn't know. And it would turn out that I'd find out. I'd find out. EST, the letter's short for Erhard Seminars Training, right? And it was later rebranded as a result of some of this Erhard's dalliances to a thing called Landmark Education, right? Now, I got drawn into it through some friends of mine, right? A couple of friends that I knew who knew each other started doing this. Landmark Education / EST, and boy, I gotta be careful what I say, because these are some real litigious scumbags. They sue you for everything. That's what I remember. You know, that's what I remember. Anything, anybody ever say anything that's disagreeable with them, they'll be in court, right? And now I got a right to my opinion. And as long as I'm true to that and making sure that I'm expressing an opinion based on my personal experience. See, I have observations, and I think what was going on was this and that, but I don't know exactly. It's just how it appeared to me. I walked out of it, in my own considerations going forward, with the idea of it being a quote-unquote white-collar cult. And it's probably not really an accurate depiction. It's just, those are my throw words. What it was, the basic idea behind all of it was motivation and social encouragement towards pursuing the material things you dream of having. For example, like as I am now, I've got this country element to me. I would love to have just massive acreage with horses and cattle, right? Cowboy stuff, country stuff, growing stuff, raising animals, playing the fucking acoustic guitar in the sunset, you know, having family around and big barbecues. That would be my life. That would be my choice. That's my dream. That wasn't my dream back then, 20-some years ago, but it would be my dream now. The idea is to identify exactly what it is you want in your life in those regards. Really a materialistic pursuit, right? And I'll explain that. And then everything starts to be oriented towards that outcome. Everything we do has to do with having that outcome in mind. And as we are applying our belief in the possibility continually, if we are 100% in line with that belief, we will manifest that belief. The universe will take it and give it to us, right? And there was this thing right around the same time that I got involved with this shit called The Secret. It was some DVD going around. It was on the same lines too. That if you believe strong enough, what you desire will be manifested by the universe, like returning it to you. You know, it was something on those lines, right? And it was a really weird experience for me. Now, I didn't like get involved with it. I went to an orientation. And I went to the orientation because my best friend, who died of AIDS, died of COVID, right? I've had other friends die of AIDS. One of them was my best friend at one time in my life. Nah, this guy died of the COVID, right? He got involved with this because he had friends who were into it and are really pressing him. I actually ended up going to the orientation with him because he thought it would be good for me, right? Well, he stayed with it. He like became like management levels and all, you know, maybe to the day he died. I don't know. He was a salesman, right? He was a salesman. And that's what it's kind of really geared toward. That's why I say white collar, a little iffy. It's probably not the right way to put it, but it's really about sales and marketing people meeting their goals. It was just one of the approaches. And in the 70s and 80s and 90s and always. There's somebody coming out of fucking California, and this is out of San Francisco, right? But there's always, think like Tony Robbins, there's always somebody coming out of California, like trying to sell you their success, right? I'm successful, therefore I can tell you how to be successful. Now, in order for you to learn to be successful from me, shell out money. So, right, this guy's success turns into a whole new way of making money. Right? And it just seemed to me like this is what comes from California all the fucking time. And so EST was like the early 80s or late 70s rendition of this California marketing capitalistic pyramid scheme, whatever, all this kind of stuff, you know. And I use that as a generic description for like all of these things. My experience and the orientation, it sucked. You were like trapped in this fucking place, right? You would go, they had like a little convention center rented out, and you'd go in there, and it's like they were setting up all these little rules and shit. Like if you left, you couldn't come back in, and you can't leave anyway. And it's just all this shit to force you to be in that room locked in. And then they were doing their presentation in the front of it. But well, what they were doing, and this was really fucked up to me, was, and I noticed it, you know, I picked up on it. They had a team of people doing this presentation. And, you know, workers that would like, registering you and everything like that. You saw them. You knew that they were part of what was going on. They weren't attending the orientation as new people getting involved. They were staff. And while the presentation was happening at the front of the room that you were trapped in, they had their staff people planted in the crowd. So like I'm standing there and the girl next to me is like one of their staff people. And every time somebody says something up front, they're just like cheerleaders. They just start jumping up and down and laughing and clapping and yeah, yeah, yeah. And like patting you on the back and like trying to get you like emotionally responsive to what's going on. And that is a form of group hypnosis, right? That is taking you people. We tend to have this weakness going along to get along, right? We're in a crowd situation. We don't want to stand out in opposition. We don't have the testicles enough to do that. It takes a man with a backbone to stand up. It takes a woman with a backbone to stand up and go against the current. What current? This social current. You know, you stand up for what is right. Come hell or high water. Here's your fucking high water, and if you swim with it, you're going to end up in hell. These people are promoting an entire lifestyle of pursuing your materialistic dreams and doing it their way, caught up in their system, taking your money, right? Taking your money all along the way. Do people, you know, pursue their desired outcomes and even attain them? Probably. Probably. Does that help them do it? Perhaps. And it's their choice. But you know what? I didn't want anything to do with that. In fact, you know, I'm thinking, and I was an Antichrist motherfucker in those days too. But I was at coming to the end of those days in my life. And I was already, you know, I'm hearing things like these people like having me contemplate and list out the desires I have in life. And, you know, everybody's talking about they want a yacht, they want a Corvette, they want an airplane, they want real estate, you know. And I'm thinking of things more like, I'm trying to find God. I want truth, you know. So where I was coming from was a completely different place. And their shit didn't work for that. In fact, that destroyed their shit. But my buddy, he was all about the material stuff, right? So he got sucked in by all of this stuff. Like I mentioned Tony Robbins. I don't mean to badmouth him or anybody else. He never did nothing wrong to me. I only know about Tony Robbins because, A, he was on the fucking TV 24/7 back in the 90s, you know, with his infomercials. And B, I'll probably reverse it. B, with the infomercials, but A, my best friend, and who was a very influential person in my life. He was an advocate. He quoted the guy all the time. He always had the cassettes going on in his car when we were driving around. He would lend me stuff. He swore that I should buy it. It would do me good. I did, you know. I did. So, you know, the two times in my life that I got sucked into all that California crap, as I call it, it was him doing it, you know. But after that orientation, I was out of there like a bat out of hell. I wanted nothing to do with it. I could tell. I could fucking tell. And you know what? It's not those kind of places. And I really don't have the right word for it, what that kind of society is. Like I said, I call it white-collar cult, but that ain't quite right. That's just me talking to myself, not to you. I don't really know what to call those kind of fellowships. But I do know this, that methodology is not exclusive to those sorts of fellowships. I seen that very thing happen in a church, right? The Protestants, you know, you've got your mainline denominations and you get your breakaway, you know, little cult guys that, interpret the Bible their own way and basically start up some new semblance of religion out of it based on the Bible, based on Christ. And they're very often way off the mark. But then you get into, like, they got the mega churches, right? And the mega churches, they're corporations, they're money-making, money-generating entities. They're hugely wealthy, hugely rich, and they obviously got a cookie-cutter pattern for establishing that type of wealth. You know, and I seen a fledgling mega church being born up. I was with my ex-wife, number two. She was going to this particular church, and I'm not naming any names or anything like that, but I got in there, and like, their worship music was like you'd expect. They dim the lights down on the crowd, you can't see the person next to you, all the lights are on the stage. They had like a fucking little fog / smoke thing going on. It was just what I call the pseudo U2 concert, right? they sound like U2, and they got that kind of music playing, and it's like the cheap rendition of it, and you know, they just change the words from whatever U2 might sing or whatever, like, a teenage person might sing about, like, you know, their romantic partner or whatever, and they just fill it with Jesus, you know. It's just, I hate the fucking music. I hate that music on every level, right? That sucked enough. But, you know, the idea that the lights were out on the crowd, it wasn't about me and the person I was with, the people around me. It was all about the presentation up front. So right there, it's like, wait, how is this church? How is this church if, like, we're blotted out of the picture? That all we can possibly look at is what they're presenting to us, you know? And then I saw the plants. They did the same thing. They had plants back there. When their quote-unquote pastor or preacher got up there and preached, he was preaching, and he spun it towards tithing and dropping money in the basket. And while he was getting into that, you had all these plants out in the crowd whooping it up. You know, he'd say, you got to give, and you got to give big. You got to give till it hurts. And they're out there, right? The plants, the staff people. Yeah, yeah, you got to get. And they're patting people on the back and everything. And I see this going on. It reminded me of those landmark education days. What I saw then. It's the same fucking strategy. Y'all got to be mindful in this world. People are going to draw you into shit like that. You know why? You know why people draw you into shit like that? Do they mean well? Perhaps. Or maybe not. You know, maybe deep down, it's like they know they're fucking up. But they're getting their fancy tickled in it. And they have a guilty pleasure of it all. And they would feel better if they could have somebody come in there and justify what they're doing, right? It didn't work with me and my friend. It's like I would never substantiate what that guy was. He would bring it up. Yeah, you ought to come back. No. That's fucking stupid, and you ought to quit. You couldn't have that conversation no more. And it created a fracture in the relationship I had with that person that never really was quite resolved, you know? It actually grew for a portion of time, you know? But it was a breakaway in differences. And that was some fucked up shit. But yeah, that's what fear was singing about to us when we were kids. So it's, the whole idea, like, what they were doing with I call it a group hypnosis thing, you know, with the plants and the crowds and whooping it up and patting you on the back. They're generating a false popularity, right? They're making it seem like what's being presented up there, which everybody's scratching their head and questioning. It's like, what? You know? That's how it was at Landmark, and that's how it was at the church. Every time somebody's preaching about tithing up there, you got to have half the people like, oh, this guy's just trying to pull money out of our fucking pockets. It's a natural response to it, right? Because you're looking for something authentic in a church. And that word authentic is what all the people use at Landmark, by the way. It's a great word, but it was their word for everything. You know, are you being authentic? You really got to look at it. So every time you doubted what was going on there, they challenge your authenticity. It was just a whole mind fuck. It really was. But authentic is a great word, and it's an important word. And, you know, we should, I would think, be concerned with our authenticity. But, you know, we question the authenticity of any pastor who's begging for money because we see all these fucker scumbag televangelists on TV doing that. It's a gyp job. They're ripping you off. And they're living large on it, and you know it. So you're right to have that kind of doubt. And, you know, I'm not getting into the theological argument of it all. Ultimately, it's right. It's the right thing to do. Actually, tithing ends up being the right thing to do. It's a matter of, well, where you're giving your money. That's what counts. That's what counts. It's got to be going to the right place, not the wrong place. And you have to be wise as serpents to discern that, right? But yeah, this guy, that fucking church was doing the same thing. It's generating what I call a false popularity. It's taking something that people are really not into and using group hypnosis to force you to believe it's what everybody else believes, therefore you ought to believe it too. False popularity. If you've gone to my website, Post Arlen Monologics, right? PostArlen.com, my subheading for what I call the entire thing is the art and science of unpopularity, right? I'm not trying to be popular here, and I'm not trying to convince you that I am. I could get on here, I could do this podcast, I could do this monologue, and I could tell you things like, you know, after last week's monologue, I got hit with like 150,000 emails, right? What am I doing? A, I'm fucking lying, but you wouldn't know. B, I am generating a false sense of popularity. So as you listen to me, I'm convincing you that I'm popular. Other people are listening to me. Other people have opinions on what I'm doing. And now you're in the right place. Now you're part of a society, you're part of a subculture, and, you know, tune in a couple days, I'll do another one of these. You're a part of it. You're a part of something that's happening. And it's not, and I don't want it to be that way. It's not, you know? The current benefit of what I'm doing here goes to, first and foremost, my wife. If I die, she will have something left of me that most people don't get, right? Most people don't get hours and hours and hours of their significant other speaking about all kinds of things, right? She'll always have this conversation with me. Her favorite moments in our life together has been us just having our conversations. We dated sitting in a pickup truck eating cold cuts. You know, going to Bible studies. Or whatever. But whenever we got together, maybe we'd watch a movie. We watched The Sopranos, I think, like on our phone in a pickup truck as we dated. Those were the times that she remembers best. And this is my leave behind to her if something should happen to me, you know, as well as all the life insurances and all that stuff, you know. But this is like the true value of it all. And it's hopefully be out there for posterity, for, like I mentioned earlier, people maybe 50, 60, 100 years out in the future making reference back to this COVID era or this post-Arlen, Texas era or just this year for whatever it is, 2023. That's what it's about. It's not about generating money. It's not about generating popularity. I'm just doing what I'm doing. If it gets wheels, it gets wheels. If it don't, it don't. But I still do it. Why? For the reasons I described. The art and science of unpopularity. So you talk about authenticity. The guy who's not trying to gain anything out of you, he's probably a little bit more genuine than the person who wants your fucking money. Amen.
Thank you for tuning into Post Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.